Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show. And on this weekend show, we are going to be really looking ahead to that upcoming Fed meeting next week. I know all eyes are on the Fed, and I know we're all getting tired about talking about the Fed, but hey, there actually might be some changes to policy made in that next meeting, argument being maybe those changes are already priced in. That being said, we are also going to chat metals and markets as we always do. We're kicking off the show with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Now, Mike, let's start off big picture, because what we're seeing is U.S. equity markets, they've lost some of that momentum to the upside. That being said, we had the S&P and the Dow, I believe, that just recently touched some all-time highs. But again, there doesn't seem to be that bullishness or even complacency, I would say, within those markets. And on the flip side of things, when you look at commodities, those went through another pop this week. And precious metals, well, they are also moving higher, but they're kind of being outpaced by some of the other commodities. And then on the bond front, we've seen yields pull back a little bit. And that is in the face of all these bond bears out there. Mike, when you take a step back and look at all these moves for the markets, what catches your eye? What's most important?
Sure. I think, you know, we had some fears and concerns, kind of the typical stuff you see in September and early October, whether it was about China's Evergrande, whether it was about a potentially more aggressive Fed. You know, you mentioned what the Fed is likely to do. And it seems like people have pretty much settled in the idea at the November meeting, they're going to announce that, yes, we're finally going to start tapering. And then they'll probably start doing that, in fact, in December, and then, you know, rolling over into the first few months or maybe first half of next year. The markets kind of came to grips with that, priced that risk in, and then decided, well, this is still not going to be a super aggressive Fed. They're not going to really slam on the brakes. This is not 94, 95 all over again, or anything like that. So, you know, we can step back in and buy. Plus, the earnings outlook isn't really terrible. And even though we're not getting as much fiscal stimulus as maybe some people are hoping, we're also not seeing, you know, any of these ideas to, you know, tax the heck out of the economy passing or get it coming through either. So you roll it all together, and that's why we kind of see parts of the market where the broad average is at or testing new highs again. I think when you look at sort of, again, the interest rate outlook, we've seen, you know, a lot of the sort of, okay, inflation numbers stink. Let's be honest, they are very strong. But the bond market is reacting as if it's going to be, you know, met by some Fed hiking at the short end, nothing too aggressive, but a few hikes maybe. And that's going to basically revert the attention back to what we've been in longer term. And that is a generally deflationary economy or an aging population, too much debt piled on all levels of the economy. And really, this sort of the demographic and structural issues that we face leave us in a world where in the advanced economies, whether it's the U.S., whether it's Japan, Europe, and so on, I just can't hike rates all that much without breaking the economy, breaking, you know, or making it too expensive to service all this debt. And so Fed hiking cycles die out at lower levels with each successive iteration. So I think, you know, that's kind of what the bond market's looking at. We've seen the yield curve flatten quite a bit. Particularly this week when the Bank of Canada came out and said and suggested they may hike sooner than expected, dialing back their QE dramatically. That led to a big sharp move higher at the short end of the yield curve, but nowhere near anything like that at the long end. So the curve flattened dramatically in Canada's bond market. We saw it in the U.S. and also in Europe to some degree as well. And I think that's what we're going to be seeing going forward. So you roll it all together, it's a market environment where you're not going to see really aggressive monetary tightening, even as the Fed tries to normalize somewhat. And I don't think we're really looking at a recession or anything horrible like that in terms of what may happen with growth. So all of it together is a generally modestly bullish environment for stocks, by and large. And I think it's still very bullish for companies that pay dividends where you can, you know, get a better than bond market yield, especially where those dividends are growing. So, you know, that's been a favorite sector of mine for quite some time, and it still is. And I think that's ultimately how you want to position yourself in this market as an investor.
Well, Mike, you made some great points there setting the table. And it's interesting to think about if the market has already priced in the tapering for the most part, and they've digested that news, the Fed is still planning on doing the rate hikes next year. And as you mentioned, each Fed rate hiking cycle has ended earlier than expected and been successively lower. You mentioned the crushing debt amounts, which we've heard that, you know, narrative for some time. But do you think that the market is fully pricing in, the general markets and the bonds, that these hikes actually are going to happen and get anywhere close to inflation? Because with CPI readings near 5 and with the, you know, the 10-year about a point and a half, or, you know, 150 points at 1.5%, they can't really take it up to 5%, can they, or even 4% without there being some major market dislocations. So what do you think that we'll be navigating as we move through this November meeting with the market expectations on those hikes?
Sure. If you look at what the bond market, the futures market's pricing in, they have been pulling forward in the last few months the date of the first Fed hike into sort of mid to late 2022. And they have been increasing speculation about a couple of hikes versus maybe one, and then the others coming at 2023. So you've seen some pulling forward of the pricing of Fed moves. But interestingly, again, you haven't seen the long end of the curve freak out about that. You've seen 10-year yields that still haven't eclipsed their sort of March levels, and 30-year yields that are maybe 20, 30 basis points below those peaks and look to be rolling over. And as I mentioned, all those yield curve measures are flattening pretty dramatically. So what does that tell you? That tells you the bond market, the market overall's expectation is, yes, we're probably going to get more Fed action at the front end than we were thinking 6 months ago. But no, that doesn't get us, you know, everything that's happening in the economy now and the inflation outlook for the next year or two doesn't get us to a point where we have a 1970s style runaway inflation. It's more of after this, the fiscal impulse, when you think of all that fiscal stimulus, starts to fade, which is kind of what it's looking like. You think of some of those things that were happening on the unemployment aid front and other infrastructure spending maybe not being as much as it was, you know, originally thought to be. All of those things, people are saying, okay, this fiscal spending is going to sort of fade. The COVID-related bottlenecks are going to fix themselves over the next, you know, couple of quarters. It's not going to be something where we have all these ships parked off the coast of, you know, Los Angeles or Long Beach for the next 5 years. And on top of that, you're going to have a Fed that, again, is trying to take some of that stimulus away at the front end. So the market is saying, sure, things look pretty bad now. The inflation numbers are high. They're, you know, real yields stink. But ultimately, some of those things that caused inflation to pick up are going to fade in the next year or two. The Fed's going to be forced to act. Therefore, it's not going to be this, again, 70s style runaway thing. It doesn't mean the markets can't be ultimately wrong at some point, but that's what they're increasingly pricing in. And that's, I think, the message there. I think it's enough that, again, it's sort of a modestly bullish environment for equities and for things like precious metals. If the Fed's not going to be able to do all that much, which is my expectation, and if foreign central banks aren't going to be able to, you know, go on this sort of rate hiking rampage because of their own debt issues, then, you know, that does tend to support metals. And that does, I think, you're starting to see, along with the curve flattening, you're starting to see some, you know, gold mining shares firm up. I mean, they're not doing anything extraordinary, but we did recently see for a thing like GDX, you know, 2-3 month highs there, or flirting with those highs. We have seen, you know, some of the metals themselves stabilize here. I think that ultimately, if the markets realize and sort of appreciate this is not going to be, again, an aggressive Fed hiking cycle, then they can come to terms with a couple of hikes and maybe some dialing back of QE. And we can see that upside for gold and silver and miners that I think we're still looking at. Again, nothing that I've seen policy-wise has changed my opinion that we're in sort of the fifth, sixth inning of this move.
So, Mike, I do agree with you. It's going to be a slow process, right? And we actually don't know how the market's going to react to it. But all we can actually predict right now, or at least watch, is short-term moves when we get, again, some or at least a possible policy change in terms of winding down the QE program. Even this week, we saw the Bank of Canada on Wednesday come out and essentially stop their QE program. We saw a bounce in the Canadian dollar. We also saw a general rise in yields in Canada. What should we be watching for next week when the Fed, or if the Fed, does taper some QE?
I think any surprises, you know, are what we're all watching for. The consensus seems to be they'll make the decision to do it, but they probably won't actually start cutting, I think, until, or reducing the amount of bonds purchased until December or maybe January. You know, it's sort of, we've been through this long dragged out process, right? Where we're not even thinking about raising rates. And now it's well, okay, we're going to drop a bunch of hints in the media that we're, you know, thinking about maybe tapering, and then we're going to tell you we're going to taper, and then we're not actually going to do it until the next meeting. Again, I think what the markets are telling you is, as long as there's no surprises, we probably have, you know, we'll price in a little more front-end action. We'll have the back end of the yield curve basically get bought, because people will say, well, they're going to act against inflation now. It keeps it from getting really out of control later. Plus, we're going to lose that fiscal spending. Plus, we have a bunch of asset markets that can't handle higher rates. So, therefore, we're not going to get them. Because, again, this Fed is so hyper-focused on markets. Fiscal policy makers, they don't want to rock the boat on, you know, they may talk a big game about sort of populism and things like that. They want to, you know, come out with an economic plan that makes the Dow tank 10% on a given Monday. Of course not. Neither does the Fed, right? So I think that they're going to be in a situation where they are somewhat trapped longer term. The bond market's telling you that. And I think that's why, you know, I put out a few tweets I remember back in April, May timeframe, where it's kind of just, you know, thinking out loud, hey, maybe this is it for this curve move. Maybe unlike in past expansion cycles where, you know, you had maybe another 100 points of curve steepening coming, maybe this is it. And we're going to just sort of die out at a lower level than we have in the past. And that's been what's happened. So I think that at this point, I'm really not, don't see any reason to sort of change that way of thinking and continue to not be freaking out about a big backup in interest rates and not be freaking about the impact that might have on precious metals.
Well, Mike, it's an interesting environment where some traders have had really great runs in the general markets for about the last six quarters. And there's also some talk from the administration in the U.S., from the Biden administration, about raising the taxes on capital gains and even potentially taxing non-realized capital gains yet that are still on the paper. So do you think that there could be some pressure in the markets towards the end of this year for traders to pull their profits and pull on their horns a little bit and get more defensive and possibly rotate some funds over to some of those dividend stocks that you follow so closely? Or do you think that it's just a smooth ship sailing forward into the first and second quarter? What do you think?
You know, I think a lot of what's being thrown out there, it's a lot of sort of policy spaghetti being thrown at the wall to see what sticks, right? You know, one day it's, okay, we're going to have this billionaire's wealth tax. And then the next day, well, we can't do that. How about we figure out a way, you know, to tax those unearned or untaken gains? Okay, that doesn't work. Well, maybe now let's figure out a way to, you know, eliminate the step-up basis so people get taxed on, you know, the sort of death benefits that people get when the heirs inherit money from the previous generation. And on, you know, there's a lot of stuff being talked about, but, you know, there's been enough resistance that it kind of hasn't, you know, some of this stuff is probably going to get through, but it's going to be qualified. I don't think the most radical suggestions on the tax side, just like the most radical suggestions on the spending side, are going to happen. I mean, you know, the Democrats, despite having that Senate tie-breaking vote from the vice president, still, you know, the reality is even just a couple of slightly more conservative Democrats are really putting the screws to the radical wing, the progressive wing, and forcing them to compromise. So, you know, if something were to pass that is truly punishing for the markets, then, yeah, we're all going to wake up and have a bad week because we're going to sell off 6%. But, you know, the fact that it hasn't happened, the fact that a lot of this stuff is being kind of dialed back tells me that the general consensus is not as far on that progressive side of the policymaking sort of spectrum as I think maybe some were worried about. So, you know, I don't know that I would call it just smooth sailing and no worries and what have you there. But I do think, again, this sort of steady grind higher, unless there's a monetary shock, unless there's a true tax shock that comes through, is probably the best way to play it from an investor standpoint. And we'll kind of reevaluate after the new year and see where things stand, you know, later in the first quarter.
Yeah, that grind has really been the trend, hasn't it there, Mike? I want to get you out of here. And one other comment. When it comes to commodities, look, we've seen stuff like the base metals run to at least close to all-time highs or multi-year breakout levels. Energy on the oil front, natural gas, those have also been screaming higher. Oil's at somewhere around a seven-year high. And then the precious metals, those have also moved higher, but those are nowhere near their highs, really, at least when you compare it to some of the moves we've seen in base metals and energy. What's the balance here? Have you seen this environment before, and what do you take away from it?
You know, again, I think it goes back to just the concerns that we're entering a tightening cycle. You know, even I think that whenever people have seen that or seen the first hints of that, and you know, you look at where did this sort of long correction in gold and silver begin? What, about a year ago? What did that sort of coincide with? The initial kind of, okay, people are starting to get vaccinated. You know, the worst of this COVID thing does appear to gradually be turning, and plus markets were rallying so much that I think people started to realize the Fed's not going to be able to keep at this game forever. So what happened? You saw Treasury bond prices top out. You saw the dollar begin to bottom, and you saw gold and silver begin to, you know, enter this sort of long corrective phase. I think now, again, I think especially when you look at the yield curve, markets are starting to say, okay, maybe we overreacted. Maybe we were over worried that there's going to be some sharp snap, you know, sharp reaction. There's going to be some serious policy making aggression like we had in the past. And I just don't see that happening. So I think that's probably what you're starting to see now. I mean, base metals all along are benefiting from the economic environment, right? You're still having that COVID recovery, the demand recovery, and all of the economic recovery. So that's what's driving base. You know, what's been holding back precious has just been the concerns about how the policy response is going to be. But if those concerns are starting to ease, which I think is what we're starting to see, then, you know, maybe that pressure comes off and, you know, we're not necessarily off to the races, but we are ready to get back into resuming the general bull market in metals and precious.
Well, Mike, just one other sector we should touch on real quick before we wrap up, and that's the cryptocurrencies. They've had quite a crazy run lately, and some of that is being predicated on the comments coming out of JP Morgan and some other places that Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation. And with more of the market waking up to these high energy prices, higher wages, and higher inflation, do you think that that's the narrative that's going to stick for a while, or what do you make of the recent run in cryptos?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I listened to some great commentary at a recent conference, and it was sort of a gold bug type environment. And I think, you know, people were starting to realize and talk about, there were a few guests speaking about crypto, that we're saying, look, we're all on the same team, right? Your people who are investing in crypto, by and large, are generally trying to get their money out of a sort of a traditional banking system and into something that could potentially hold wealth, just like the traditional gold and silver buyers. So I think you're starting to see an appreciation that, hey, we can coexist, right? This doesn't have to be an either or situation. There are reasons to allocate money to precious metals, but also reasons to allocate money to crypto. And I think, you know, that's part of the sort of institutionalizing that we're starting to see in the cryptocurrency market. And then there's also, yes, there's a lot of shenanigans going on. There's a lot of just funny sort of play money YOLO type trading that people are doing in portions of the crypto market. But as it gets a little more mainstream, as it grows as an asset class, you're going to see, you know, you're going to see movement there that I think, an adoption there that I think is probably a good long-term trend to play as well.
Really is the fact that the crypto market does seem like it's here to stay, whether the gold bugs want to admit it or not. And the thing is, the crypto bulls have a lot of the same thoughts as the gold bulls too, but the gold bulls were really hating on crypto through the last couple of years. And now they're finally starting to accept that, look, we are similar. It's just different asset classes that people are looking at. And unfortunately, it's a younger audience that is in a bit more to cryptos. But overall, look, Mike, it seems like we're really just waiting for the turn of the calendar to 2022 and to see just how far central banks, especially the Fed, can go with the tightening and unwinding process. Next week, man, oh man, that'll be possibly the start of it. We're all looking forward to that. So, Mike, great having you on the show. Thank you, as always, for taking time on this weekend show, and we will chat again in another couple weeks. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Same to you guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in this segment now, we are focusing a bit more on the resource sector as we are chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. We are going to talk about precious metals, also look at some of the other commodities that overall October has been a pretty good month for commodities broadly. Seemed like the base metals went on a run, quite a euphoric run early on for the first half, about two-thirds of October. And the precious metals also continued to seem like grind higher. However, we did see at the tail end, or well, on Friday, the last trading day of the month, general pullback in a lot of these metals, especially the precious metals. But overall, Jeff, let's start with the precious metals, because throughout this month, I've noticed some of the commentary coming out of the CPM group generally a bit more bullish than I had seen the last few months, even throughout this year. I know that you guys are bullish on precious metals longer term, but break down what some of your recent commentary in terms of the precious metals is outlined, please.
Well, yeah, we still have the same, pretty much the same long-term bullish expectation for our gold and silver and for platinum and palladium. We're actually just now updating our platinum group metals supply, demand, price projections. We take them out to 2050 because of the uncertainty surrounding future motive trans propulsion technologies. But, you know, we've had this view that gold and silver will probably rise sharply mid-decade due to economic and financial and political problems coming home to roost. And we still maintain that. Where we've seen some shifts are in a shorter term, you know, the next week or two, the next month, and the next really five quarters, like through 2022. You know, our view, it's actually been tilting. So our view has been that we thought that the gold and silver prices would rise modestly over the course of the fourth quarter of this year and through 2022. And now what we're thinking is that maybe we're seeing a little bit stronger prices in the fourth quarter of this year and then more moderation in 2022. And that reflects a couple things. One is it reflects the reality of what's been going on in October price-wise and in terms of investment demand. But it also reflects a view that 2022 may see more sanguine economic expectations on the part of financial markets. And, you know, we've sort of seen gold and silver trade in a range over the last month or two. But the range, actually, if you look at it more closely, we've seen gold and silver prices rising over the course of October. And, you know, it's not so much a range as what technicians would call ascending triangles. And you're seeing gold, you know, test the upper ceiling of it, gold and silver testing the upper ceiling of these ascending triangles. So gold's tested 1810 a couple times, really, since it sold off in late September. And silver has been testing, you know, the higher ends of its range, which, you know, really is around 2480 to $25 an ounce. And our expectation is that over the next couple months, you may well see those prices break and you might see, you know, silver rise a dollar or so. We don't see it running away, you know, sharply. But the idea that it gets to $26 or $27 or even $28 between now and early January is well within probability scales that we look at. You know, and with gold, a break above 1800, 1810, 1820 could see the price go up back to 1840 or so relatively quickly. So we're looking at a little bit more strength in the fourth quarter. But then we're looking at a more sanguine view of the economy and maybe flatter prices in 2022 relative to what we had been thinking about earlier. We had been thinking about modest increases over the course of the year. And if investors become a little bit more confident about the economy next year, and there are some signs that they may that shift may occur, then you could see precious metals sort of tread water more next year before ultimately starting to rise as the economic and financial environment deteriorates longer term.
Yeah, Jeff, that sets the table nicely. And really, the precious metals have been stuck in a pricing channel. I guess you could call it a range. I mean, really, the $1,800 level for gold has been a magnet for the last few months. You could have fallen asleep 3 or 4 months ago and woken up and it's still at the same place today. Silver was getting in the danger zone down around 2150, but it has bounced up into the mid-24s. And as you point out, a move up a couple bucks would still be still in that larger range silver's been in between 22 to 28. But no sign that anytime soon it's going to bust out above 30 or anything like that. Same thing with gold. It's still got a lot of resistance levels above it. Even at 1840, there's more above it at 1900, 1920. So a lot of work for the precious metals to do. The mining stocks have done a little better recently and outperformed the metals. But one thing I've noted, Jeff, is the silver has started outperforming gold a little bit. And my question is, do you think that that's because of the industrial component with silver, because gold really hasn't done much, but silver's caught up. But we've noticed the other commodities run, as Corey mentioned in the intro, like copper is up to near all-time highs, zinc is at 16-year highs, lead's up, nickel's up, the commodities like the energy space, oil and nat gas are up. Do you think silver's benefited from that commodity run?
I think silver's benefiting from the commodity run and also some of the background behind the commodity run. I mean, what you're finding is a lot of investors buying into the electrification of the global economy, a shift away from hydrocarbons to electricity, which is actually not necessarily an accurate portrayal of what's happening or going to happen, and an increased market share of electric vehicles. And, you know, there's a view that all of this electrification of transportation as well as other aspects of the economy will lead to greater demand for industrial metals. So aluminum, copper, nickel, and silver is benefiting from that too. You know, the typical car right now probably uses a little less than 1 ounce of silver per car. And it's used in thousands of connectors and contacts in the electrical system of the car. Electric vehicles probably use twice as much metal. So if you're seeing an increase of, say, from 2 million electric vehicles in 2019 to 4 million last year to 6.5 million this year, you're seeing, you know, a couple million ounces more of demand. But people are looking at electric vehicles and they're saying, our view is that they won't gain market share as quickly as the politicians and the corporate chieftains say, but they will gain market share. And people are saying, okay, so if you're going to be using twice as much silver per car and you're going to be shifting to electric cars, that's electric vehicles, that should greatly increase the demand for silver. And it will increase the demand for silver, but, you know, our expectation is that it might add 16 million ounces of fabrication demand totals over the next 9 years. So that's not going to set the silver market on fire in reality. But right now, what you're seeing are investors buying into that story. You know, by 2030, a significant portion of the auto population will be electric cars, and they'll be using a lot more silver.
So, Jeff, looking out to 2030, it is important, but when it comes to investment horizons, everybody is a lot more short-term than that, right? And the big elephant in the room, at least coming next week, is that Fed meeting and the expected start of the taper program. How do you see this playing out in terms of its impacts on precious metals or the broad commodity complex?
I think it's going to add to the uncertainty that has kept gold and silver in a range, for example. And I think it's relatively, the actual effects, I think, will be relatively small. But you're going to see increased volatility across financial markets as investors try to wrestle with what it really means. I mean, and it's already there. If you look at the 10-year bond, for example, the 10-year yields really rose sharply over the last couple of weeks. And then in the last couple of days, they gave it all up. So the realization is that, yeah, interest rates probably aren't going to rise as the Fed tapers or pulls back from its accommodative things. But what you'll see is that they will be buying fewer bonds, and that will reduce the largesse, which is probably, that would be negative for commodities, but for the fact that they're doing it because they see a stronger economy.
Well, Jeff, we talked to so many different people that are thought leaders in the space and different people that are looking at the precious metals or just macroeconomics. And if we distilled down the two arguments for higher precious metals, they'd have to be that some people are waiting for possibly a market rout because of the Fed action. If they decide to start hiking rates next year, for example, earlier than expected, that market rout may help the precious metals. And the other argument is that if the Fed starts a rate hiking cycle, it seems counterintuitive, but a lot of times when they start hiking rates in a negative real rate environment, that it actually is a boon to the precious metals. Do you like either one of those explanations for what could move the precious metals moving into 2022, or how do you see it?
Yeah, I don't expect the stock market rout. You know, people have been saying that it's going to collapse for a long, long time, probably longer than I've lived. but I don't see a stock market rout because I think the stock market has been benefiting from stock buybacks, monetary largesse. I think there's plenty of money out there that will keep the stock market from falling sharply. So I don't see that that's going to be a factor that would trigger higher gold and silver prices. The second thing that you were talking about was the interest rates, I guess. A lot of times what you'll see is that when interest rates are rising, what's important is not that they're rising. The important thing is, how does the market interpret it? Does the market say, oh, interest rates are rising because inflation is a problem and the Fed is behind the ball? That's bullish for gold and silver. But other times you'll see in the financial market say, oh, interest rates are rising because inflationary pressures are growing, but the Fed's on top of this and they're raising interest rates early. And if that happens, then it's a negative. My view is that in the next period of time, when we see upward pressures on interest rates, people will take it more in the former case. Well, inflation is rising and the Fed has going to have a difficult time dealing with it. I happen to think that inflation is not all that problematic and that the Fed has plenty of ammunition to use to fight inflation. So I don't think it's going to be a big issue, but what I think doesn't matter. What matters is the consensus in the market. And the market is inclined to be concerned about inflation right now and to think that the Fed doesn't have a good handle on the economy. I think the market's wrong in both accounts, which means that you could see precious metals prices rise, and then when reality sinks in, they could come back off.
Jeff, how long are you going to continue to be in the camp of essentially calling this inflation transitory, or at least saying that the Fed does have the ammo and the tools to pull back inflation? Honestly, I'm on the fence. I don't know. You hear so many different arguments right now that say inflation is taking off. I'm not in that whole hyperinflation narrative, but at the same time, look, the Fed has got itself kind of in this corner here where it is going to have to potentially deal with inflation if it does keep on running into next year. What's your time frame in essence of when the Fed probably will need to act for inflation if it does keep running higher than expected?
I don't really have a time frame because I look more at trends in the actual valuations in the market rather than a timing. And one of the points that we've made repeatedly is that, you know, when you start breaking down inflation and you look at it, yeah, there are actually some non-transitory inflationary pressures in the economy. And you have to understand that it's not an either or transitory or permanent inflation problem. It's a mixture, and you have to say, okay, this is a permanent or a semi-permanent or a secular shift that has inflationary consequences. And then there are these other things that are cyclical or transitory. And I think that the bulk of the inflation that we've been seeing has been transitory. And if you look at the inflation, not as a year over year data, but as a month to month data, you'll see that the big spike in inflation in consumer prices in the United States were March, April, May. And then June, July, August, September, we have seen lower month-to-month inflation rates. And that supports my view that a lot of the inflation is, in fact, transitory. But other people look at the year-over-year. And another point that we keep making is that right now you're looking at, you know, August and September price levels compared to August and September of 2020, which was the height of the global lockdown when no one was buying anything. So you had prices weak a year ago, and now people are coming out and they're buying stuff. There are supply deliveries. inflationary issues. There are cost issues on the labor front. You have a 90% turnover of truck drivers in the United States per year. You know, it's funny because, you know, I was watching the news and they were talking about the supply chain and delivery problems, and they're showing the port of Long Beach, California, and they're talking about how people can't get cereal. Well, cereal doesn't come from overseas. It comes from, you know, Michigan. and it's not a matter of ships at sea. It's a matter of trucks and the lack of truck drivers. Now, you go forward a year from now, and you're going to be measuring year-over-year inflation of high price levels in August and September of 2021 compared to whatever the levels are in 2022. And my expectation is that the levels will be flat to lower for a lot of categories in with a lot of the components within the CPI. So, you know, I'm not saying, well, okay, I think that by April of next year that I'll be able to say this is transitory, this is not transitory. What I see is that we're going to have a process over the next, say, 12 months or so where the inflation indicators are reduced while at the same time economic output indicators probably strengthen. So you're going to have a stronger economy and lower inflation. You'll see continued improvement in the labor market. And those things are probably going to combine to cause investors to say, okay, the economy is not as in bad of shape as I thought it was. It's probably in better shape than I thought it was. And that's not necessarily a positive thing for investing in gold and silver.
Well, Jeff, just shifting over to the platinum and palladium markets real quick before we wrap, because I know you follow that space closely. Two things I want to ask you about. One is we see the increased narrative around fuel cells and how platinum and palladium may be important to that. And then the other question I have is, with palladium prices being so much higher than platinum historically, do you think that there's a risk of a replacement aspect to the palladium and in favor of platinum moving forward in industry?
Yeah, well, the second question first. Yes, definitely you're seeing that, and you're already seeing it. You're seeing wherever possible people in industries and applications are shifting more toward platinum and away from palladium. And that's why, you know, the spread between these, the metals prices has fallen in half. You know, palladium is around $1,900 right now. Platinum's around $1,000. But if you go back a few months, platinum was around $1,000 and palladium was around $2,000 or $3,000. So, you know, you're already seeing that shift being reflected in the price. And I think that that will continue over the next year or so. In terms of fuel cells, my view is that fuel cells make sense for stationary power and also for fleet. So inner city buses and airport fleets, vehicles, all those things running around the tarmac or forklifts and warehouses, you know, places where you have a fleet manager who can handle fueling hydrogen into a car. I don't think that fuel cells make sense for on-road transportation, like, you know, light-duty vehicles that people are driving, simply because it's too expensive and dangerous to ship, store, and deliver hydrogen at this point. And also, I think the fuel cell cars and technology is still very expensive and temperamental. It's gotten less temperamental, but it still is temperamental. So I don't see fuel cells taking big market share in the vehicle market. And also, as we've seen, you know, for 50 years, research at limiting the amount of platinum and palladium. Well, palladium hasn't really been used in fuel cells, but platinum has. And you've seen, you know, a 99% reduction in platinum requirements. And you have any number of fuel cell manufacturers now saying they can produce fuel cells that don't use platinum. So I don't think that fuel cells will be a major source of demand for platinum, and I don't think they'll be a major form of mode of transportation for on-road passenger vehicles, small trucks, and big trucks too.
All right, Jeff, we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you for taking kind of that broad look ahead for a wide range of metals, mostly the precious metals, and where you see inflation going, because that continues to be the big topic to discuss here, is where inflation is going and what the Fed can do to stem inflation if it does keep running higher. But again, I think all focus is on next year and just where inflation goes, what the Fed does, and what the market volatility is on the back of that. Jeff, always great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Yeah, take care.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right. Welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're shifting focus a little bit in this final segment for a pretty important company update. News that broke this week out of Caliber Mining on October 25th. The company is acquiring Fiore Gold. We have on the line with us Vice President of Corporate Development and Investor Relations, Ryan King. Caliber Mining is traded on the TSX under the symbol CXB and on the OTCQX under the symbol CXBMF. Now, the acquisition being Caliber will acquire 100% interest in Fiore's operating Pan Gold Mine, as well as the adjacent Advanced Stage Gold Rock Project and the past producing Epala Gold Project, all in Nevada. This transaction will now create a diversified, America's-focused mid-tier gold producer in Caliber Mining, with now targeted annual gold production of just short of 250,000 ounces. The exact number, about 245,000 ounces. Now, Ryan, this was one of the biggest news releases that came out this week from the resource sector. Just start off, please, giving us a little recap of this acquisition and what it means for Caliber now increasing their production.
Sure, Corey. Thanks very much, Corey and Chad. Appreciate the time to discuss the transaction, because I think these types of deals are what a lot of our institutional audience, active managers, are looking for in the space. And Caliber set out years ago as a prospect generator. In 2018, we restructured the company on the back of the success that our same management team and board had with New Market Gold. New Market Gold was a publicly traded company. We acquired gold production. We optimized it. We merged that company with Kirkland Lake to create a diversified, not only geographically, but a larger base, almost a 500,000 ounce a year gold producer in Canada and Australia, which went on to do incredibly big returns for shareholders. So with Caliber, the group said, that was successful. We can create a lot of value that way. Let's focus on doing that again. And, your audience knows that in 2019, after the restructure, we had said we wanted to acquire gold production. And so we were able to successfully strike a win-win deal with B2 Gold. They're our largest shareholder. They were the ones that basically modernized and brought modern mining to Nicaragua, and then these assets became small, less than 5% of their NAV. So they wanted to surface value by partnering with Caliber. And so over the last couple of years, we've been optimizing that production and growing that production base there. And always we had mentioned to the market and to yourselves and your audience that we wanted to grow into be a multi-asset, multi-jurisdictional, 500,000 ounce quality mid-tier gold producer. And with this week's announcement, that's a step in that direction to do that. And so and we're really focusing on acquiring that production that has growth potential or optimization potential built into it. And we see that through this transaction. So a very exciting time for Caliber and Fiore. And I really believe that this is going to be a situation where, through the pro forma Caliber, we'll have the financial strength, we'll have a very similar operating and an operating culture that we can advance collectively and unlock a lot of value. So it's going to be an exciting time here as we transition to be a multi-jurisdictional gold producer with a lot of growth potential going forward.
Well, Ryan, walk us through some of the specifics on the new combined company, you know, as far as what will the production metrics be, you know, what will the gold resources be, what will the average cost be, just, you know, what will the combined entity look like moving forward?
You bet. As we recall, we initially acquired the Nicaraguan assets, and one of those assets we're heading towards closure. In 2020, Calibre produced 136,000 ounces. This year, Nicaragua alone, we were guiding 170 to 180,000 ounces. Now with the acquisition and, you know, anticipated to close in early January, pro forma company based on analyst consensus would be, you know, somewhere just below 250,000 ounces a year over the next two years on average. We're working through all the budgets and details to come out with official guidance for 2022, but that's based on analyst consensus numbers for the two jurisdictions. And based on analyst consensus, we'd be around $1,000 to $1,100 all-in sustaining costs. But what that does there is, obviously, as we mentioned, diversifies. We've got a growing production portfolio with one of the assets acquired and with our Eastern Borosi project coming online and their Gold Rock project coming online. We could see the company growing to 300 plus thousand ounces of annual gold production. In terms of the mineral endowment, collectively, the company is now well above 7 million ounces of measured, indicated, and inferred. And so it's a nice, solid base of which to grow from. And I think on almost every metric in talking to various analysts and institutional shareholders, this was an accretive deal and a win-win situation for both sides with the plus 40% premium. But also all of the significant growth catalysts within both Calibre and Fiore suite of assets.
Ryan, do you have any more information on what the estimated costs are going to be of production when the transaction is completed?
Well, still more work to do going through all of that. And we haven't provided 2022 budgets yet, but I would think probably very similar to what 2021's all-in sustaining cost guidance would be. Particular for the Nicaraguan assets next year, around $1,000 to $1,100 all-in sustaining costs. Based on analyst consensus over the next 2 years, because of a declining cost profile at both assets, analyst consensus is right around $1,000 all-in sustaining costs. But you know, we still have to work through all of the details of that budget. But an attractive profile nonetheless, with a declining cost profile and an increasing production profile for the combined assets.
Yeah, not too shabby of a margin there with $1,800 gold either. So one of the things, Ryan, that I think Calibre had as a knock against it was the jurisdiction risk in Nicaragua. Even though you guys have been blowing and going and exploring and ramping up your hub and spoke model and done a great job in Nicaragua with the B2 gold assets, there were still investors that were a little shy. And now you're bringing Nevada in, the number one Fraser Institute jurisdiction to be in on the planet, for gold. So do you think this will change how institutional funds and investors or even retail investors view the combined entity now?
I do. Actually, it's you know, one of the reasons that we saw the value in this deal was A, scale and geographical diversification. And you're absolutely bang on, Chad. We definitely had folks that were reluctant to hear about what we were doing in Nicaragua because of the jurisdiction. But we have demonstrated over and over the last couple of years, and B2 Gold demonstrated over the last decade prior to us acquiring the assets, that that you can operate efficiently and safely and effectively in Nicaragua. And I believe that will continue to be the case. I mean, case in point, we've received permits for open pit mining. We have consistent, regular, and welcome transparent communication with communities and government. And as well, we've recently been awarded new mineral concessions and a permit for in-pit tailings going forward. So we've found working in Nicaragua very, very supportive to foreign entities working in the country, assuming they're, of course, following international codes of conduct and, of course, their mining legislation. But from an investor standpoint now, yeah, I mean, it really does open up an opportunity there by by acquiring the Nevada assets and balancing out that geopolitical portfolio that we have. And what's interesting is as you look through the metrics of this deal and look at the resource and reserve base, 42% of the overall resources in the pro forma company will come out of North America, out of the United States. 58% will come from Nicaragua. And so as you diversify your asset base, obviously diversifying your production profile, and what's exciting from our perspective as well is we see a growing production profile in Nevada with their Gold Rock project, which could double annual gold production by bringing that adjacent development stage project online.
Let's talk about some of those growth avenues then and how the combined company now will add value to some of those assets within Fiore. Take us through the Gold Rock project and anywhere else that you guys see as near-term growth potential then.
For sure, yeah. And I think most of your audience is aware of our hub and spoke strategy, which has been very accretive and very effective. We've been growing. We first and foremost, we set a great platform at the end of 2020 by announcing a 200% increase in our reserves, the largest reserve over the last 10 years between Limón, Libertad, and Pavón, but also the highest grade reserve ever collectively amongst these assets. And we see additional growth potential, as we've talked about with your audience, is Eastern Borosi. You know, that's an inferred resource, almost 700,000 ounces at 4.9 grams per ton gold. We've been advancing that through infill drilling, through all of the technical work. We're getting very close now to submitting a package for permitting. And if you recall, remember Pavón, we were able to permit within 12 months for an open pit, high-grade open pit deposit. You don't need the tailings, of course. We don't need new infrastructure, so very low capital cost because we would be utilizing the Libertad processing facility, which has over 50% capacity. So there's one growth initiative that most of your audience already knows, of course, and we would anticipate that maybe the second half of 2023 or early 2024 that you can potentially start seeing some of that high-grade open-pit material from Eastern Borosi come down to the Libertad facility, obviously increasing production profile. But in terms of the acquisition with Fiore, you know, one of the opportunities that we identified and they were pretty transparent on is that, you know, a smaller operation, 40 to 50,000 ounces a year, they were self-funding themselves. They have recently expanded their heap leach pads. So that was almost a $10 million investment, which was the right thing to do, obviously. They had installed a crushing unit to help with recoveries with the pan operation. So they have been investing back into the business, very similar to what Calibre's doing. And as I mentioned, the culture, the operating focus, and the discipline on capital allocation. And yet they've only been spending about $1 to $1.5 million a year on exploration. And that's all the asset could afford them to do without going back to the market or taking on some debt. And so combined, I think this is, again, an opportunity where we can allocate more dollars to numerous targets north and south along a prolific trend within the pan landscape. They've identified a number of targets. They've got a good team there, but have been on again, off again with the drills. And so this will be an opportunity where we can really dedicate some time and focus to expanding the mine life there at Pan. And I think, you know, hopefully we'll be between 2 and 3 drill rigs, maybe plus on the Pan targets, as well as, you know, near the Pan open pits for expansion there. So I think that could be a real unlocking of value. And then we turn our focus to Gold Rock. Gold Rock is located less than 15 kilometers from Pan. And they've actually done a really good job at Gold Rock. They were able to federally permit Gold Rock. That's an arduous long process in Nevada. So that's federally permitted for up to 25,000 tons a day. In 2020, they announced a PEA that demonstrated about 55 to 60,000 ounces of annual gold production over 6.5 years, with a capex, really modest capex. I think it was about $65 million of initial capex. And there's more work that needs to be done, obviously taking it from a PEA through to pre-feas or feasibility study. And they've been advancing that, maybe not as quickly as they wanted, but but they've been advancing that project, doing metallurgical test work, which they're undergoing now and starting to get some preliminary results back in. Geotechnical drilling, condemnation drilling, all of the things that work towards putting into a final feasibility study. But what this will also allow us to do is not rush into anything. It'll allow us to go slow, really understand that project, the scope and scale of the opportunity there. And that PEA that they announced only looked at 10,000 tons per day, right? So if we now take a step back and we put some drills on a number of the great targets that they've identified and see what could surface out of that. I mean, already over the last couple of months, they've announced drill results outside of resources. They announced a new discovery about a kilometer and a half north of the Gold Rock resource. So there's, you know, clearly there's opportunity for new discoveries, resource expansion. I think that's another opportunity for us to put some rigs on there and understand what that whole landscape. I think it's like 15 plus kilometer strike extent to these resources. So that's really where we see an opportunity here. You know, pan a steady 40 to 50,000 ounce a year production profile, a lower mine life. So maybe look at extending that mine life because we can afford to do that through the balance sheet, and also look at a number of rigs on top of Gold Rock to see what the scope and scale may look like. So that's always exciting as a gold producer to be able to self-fund that, you know, that unlocking of value through the drill bit, but also be able to self-fund if we decided to do so, really push ahead with the development of Gold Rock and put that into production. We've got the financial wherewithal to be able to do that without taking on debt or going back to the market.
Well, Ryan, just as we wrap up, whenever two companies merge, there's the collision of two different cultures. And in this case, I think both cultures are on the same vibe. But would you walk us through what strengths you think you bring to the table? And you alluded to some of it there with the exploration focus Calibre will bring to Nevada. But what strengths do they bring to the table to your team? And what would the synergies between the two teams be that each one brings to the table in this transaction?
You're absolutely right. A lot of times cultures are different and can clash. But I mean, this one here, it's been a real focus on the delivery of their commitments. It's been a focus on operations, not diluting, using operating cash flow efficiently and effectively. And that's been similar to us in Nicaragua, right? Is that we were able to bring in some new human capital, bring in some financial resources and dedicate them to the Nicaraguan assets. And I believe that's exactly what they've done with Pan and Gold Rock. And so the cultures are very similar with the approach of being transparent and how we operate. And so when we look at what we could bring, again, it's sort of similar to what we did with the Nicaraguan assets. It's just another set of eyes looking at things differently. And I mean, Darren Hall, our chief executive officer of Calibre, this is what he did for Newmont for 30 years. He traveled around to producing gold mines around the world to see what could be done to optimize, whether it's, you know, a contractor rating, whether it's something on recoveries, social issue. Darren was quite successful in that. He worked in Nevada for many years for Newmont. He worked in Peru and Indonesia. So there's an aspect there that could help unlock value. But again, we recognize the really good work that the Fiore team has done. But where I see the opportunity is their history, their knowledge, and their geological team's knowledge of all the targets, all the opportunity, where they see opportunities to unlock further value now that we have the financial flexibility to be able to do that without having to go back to the market, without having to take on debt. So we're very complimentary of their team. They've done an incredible job. And with a little bit more cash, that additional operating cash flow to put back into the business, I think will be a welcome opportunity for both sides to unlock value. And we'll be looking for their key people as well to work with us on the Nicaraguan assets. Maybe there's something on the other side where they can bring with their expertise a different perspective or a different view to help unlock value.
All right, Ryan, thanks for taking some time to address this merger acquisition. It was, I think, one of the bigger news releases that came out of the resource sector this week, and I appreciate you really sharing how the combined company will be a mid-tier producer here and some of the synergies within the team, at least, that you are seeing. Ryan, again, thank you very much for your time. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Everybody, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. As always, please keep in touch with Chad and I through email. Our email addresses are fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. Be sure to visit our website and look back at all the daily editorials and company interviews we recorded throughout the week. Everybody, hope you have a great rest of your weekend.